Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
So the challenge is over to you. What do you need to make it happen, to make sure that you can deliver the right sort of quality of care in the home? Now, we have some roving mics. Any points that anybody wants to make? There's one there. Anyone else? Put your hands up so we can... Okay, the lady there, first of all. If you could stand up, and quite helpful, just say your name and where you're from, really.
Hi, I'm Meg Stowick.
Hold the mic a little bit closer.
Hi, I'm Meg Stowick, community matron in Doncaster. For me, working in the community, we're having a lot of patients where they're needing help at home, which is what we're all supposed to be delivering, but the social care funding isn't there. So these patients are being means-tested. They don't always get the services they need because they can't afford it and neither can the council. We're failing in that respect.
Okay. Sally, do you want to make a comment?
Shall we take a few? And cause
indeed.
Get as many people in as possible. And then
at the
I'll
front
come
here.
Back.
And I know... can you stand up?
Yeah.
That's good.
My name's Jane Cook. I'm a clinical nurse specialist working with homeless people and a Queen's nurse as well. I've been working with homeless people now for 27 years in November, so a long time. And I think it's just worth reminding ourselves that there are people out there who don't have a home. So making sure that nursing fits to the needs of the clients and is centred around them. We're seeing the number of homeless people go up dramatically. So street homeless by 42%. And in London, homeless families are going up by 38% and being dispersed around the country. So if you think it's not your business, it's going to become your business. So I think it's also important to look at making sure that there are the right nurses and the right skills. And there's a lot of nurses out there working with homeless people. So doing a quality impact assessment, so making sure their needs are identified and the services are properly commissioned, and that information goes into the joint strategic needs assessment as well and the health and wellbeing boards. So because that's where not only are the clients vulnerable, but nurses become vulnerable who work with homeless people, and we see the job cuts there.
Thank you. Thanks, Jane. Any other points before Sally responds? One at the back there, yes.
My name's Janine McKnight and I'm a health visitor, so I'm glad of the investment in health visiting. But one question I have got is around cost improvement programmes, Rob Peter to pay Paul. I understand that there's got to be cost improvement programmes within our trusts, but a lot of things are being slashed, which means that we have little say in what's going. So, of course, money's taken away, which compromises other areas. So if we could touch a little bit on SIP, please.
Thank you. Sally, do you want to respond to those?
Thank you. Obviously, I can't answer in terms of, oh, yes, right, you know, money for social care. But I think it's really important to have made all those points and for me to hear all those points. I had a meeting with Dan Poulter, who, as you know, is one of the new ministerial team, and nursing is in his portfolio. And it really struck me that he wanted to talk about community nursing and he wanted to talk about social care, although, you know, Norman Lamb is the Minister for Care Services, but Dan Poulter was absolutely clocked, and I'm sure this is the same for the Secretary of State, in terms of the importance of the community and the intersection between community and social care. And it is an issue, and I hear it everywhere we go. And I think, you know, what we must do is make sure that we keep saying those things, that we cannot, if people don't have the funding, whether it's in social care or Janine's point in terms of, you know, the funding for the staff to and also Jane's point, the funding for the staff to deliver the care for people. It's not going to happen. Whatever else we do in terms of initiatives, it's not going to work unless the money is there to provide the services and the staff for people. So I think all we can do is, along with you, keep making sure it's up the top of the agenda. I think the homeless point is a very, very good point, actually. Presumably, I'm looking at Jane, it will be CCGs which will be commissioning the care. okay, well, that's, you know, something we can, along with you, flag up in terms of what's going to happen in terms of homeless. And, you know, the points you make about the increasing number of homeless people because of the financial situation is really a really good one. I've written down the other points you made. Yes, and cost improvements, you know, the things that are happening in terms of cost improvements and, you know, the loss of staff and services. And I think this is part of where we're coming from in the nurse leadership theme, about making sure nurse leaders have got the tools to demonstrate what they need in order to deliver quality care. And that's partly in terms of the staff, you know, having, and I know there are gaps in the community in terms of tools to be able to demonstrate how many and what skill mix of staff you need. And I know Jane Cummins is taking this forward in terms of, you know, the gaps in where there are staffing tools. So I think, and we have said as a form, we are going to do some more work around staffing levels, but other tools as well. Nurses being able to demonstrate, and nurses, particularly at board level, not signing off changes which will impact their ability to deliver high quality care. So, you know, nurse leaders being empowered to stand up and say, I won't sign that off as a board member because it's going to compromise the care that we're delivering. So I'll leave it there, but they're all excellent points, and do grab me and make others, or, you know, contact us, and I look forward to seeing what you gather from your exercise as well. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to finish this session now because I'm going to be really bossy with time. You may be pleased or not to hear. Thank you very much, Sally. As I said at the beginning, and as Sally reiterated, reflect on what you're hearing and feel free to grab her during the day and make any additional points. But you've laid out some ground rules, some of the recommendations, some of the fundamentals that we need to be thinking about if we want to be able to deliver really high quality care in the home. So a good start. Thank you very much. Now I'm going to move on to introduce Kate Billingham. Kate is a fellow trustee on the QNI Council, and she's also a fellow of the QNI. She is now a senior advisor for the Nurse Family Partnership International at the University of Colorado, a post she's recently taken up, having finished after many years at the Department of Health just earlier on this year, in May, I think. Many of you will have known Kate with her public health involvement in the past, and so we're delighted that she's going to be chairing this panel session, and she will introduce fellow panel members. Kate.
Thank you, Ros. I'm delighted to be chairing this session because I think it's really a very, very important discussion that we're about to have. And I think it's very helpfully called Passing the Tipping Point, a home-based future, because it is really today thinking about what is that going to mean. And I think a lot of us who've worked in the community for many, many years have always been thinking, well, we're almost there, we're almost going to pass the tipping point, and it never quite happens. I think really we're facing today challenges that we never, ever could imagine, say, 5 years ago, aren't we? The world is a very, very different place than it used to be. And this is making huge demands of us. It requires us to have imagination, an openness to learn from others and other countries, and the great courage to face the future and to work together as we serve our communities and families. And I'm really privileged to be chairing this session because what the people we've got on this panel are really such high-caliber leaders in the system at the moment that I'm sure they're going to give us some new ways of thinking about this challenging future and to will inspire our imagination to think about what we can do to secure high-quality services for our families, patients and communities. And they all have many, many years of experience of proving, I think, not just their skills and ability to lead very complex services and organisations, but also of demonstrating deep personal commitment and values on which all of us here today are about. So I'm really grateful and want to thank them on our behalf for giving up their time to be here for what is a very short session, but I think this probably reflects their interest in the importance of health, of home care at this point in time, and also that they represent much wider than nursing. And I think your questions to Sally were very interesting, because actually they were nearly all about wider issues than the immediate nursing issues in the community. We're going to hear all four. I'm going to introduce them all at one time, and then we'll have all four to speak. And then we're going to have some time for questions. When you're thinking about your questions and to make the most of our panel, can you think about and reflect while you're listening about things you'd like to ask about what we all do for the future? I was very struck by Sally saying it's about saying, but it's also saying to the people that make things happen. And, of course, the people who make things happen are all of us too. It's not people out there who do things to us. And I would like us to ask questions that are relevant to what we can do in this room to take forward these visions for the future. Okay. So let me introduce our panel in order they're going to speak. You've got their biographies, so I'm not going to talk about that. Start by introducing Jennifer, who I'm delighted and have followed for many, many years, who's director of the Nuffield Trust. I think what's interesting about Jennifer is she brings today such enormous international leadership, understanding of different systems, but also many, many years of being able to combine public health, medicine, health policy and research, which is great to have. And then we've got Mike, who I'm sure many people know, who's chief executive of the NHS Confederation. And he, when I was looking at his bio, I thought he's done all of the difficult jobs, really, in the NHS, and he's stuck around to see what's happened to them afterwards. So I think that's a very courageous and a value-based. And anybody I've ever met who's worked for Mike has always had such fierce loyalty about working with him and his leadership qualities that I've always been quite envious that it's one of the things in my career, the NHS, I've never had the opportunity to do. So I'm really interested to hear what he says today. And I'm really pleased that we've got Jeremy Taylor. He is Chief Exec of National Voices. Now, this may not be an organisation we're familiar with. I hope it is. But if we're not now, we surely will be. Because I think this, what is emerging through the power of the web and changes in society as well as policy, is that the voice of patients and communities is going to be the most important thing that shapes our services from now on. So listening to Jeremy as a leader in the voluntary sector too, and from what I know of him, a very thoughtful and considered person, I think will be very interesting today. And finally, Wendy Nicholson, who I'm sure many people know from the Department of Health, who's a nursing colleague and has done some very, very interesting work around leading the school nursing and other public health nursing within the Department of Health, and is a great friend of the Queen's Nursing Institute. So I'm delighted Wendy's here today. Okay, so that's by way of introductions. So we'll have all four to go up. Jennifer, do you want to start with? It's probably easy if we stay here and do them, I think, and then it's slightly, we can have it as a more informal conversation. That's all right with you.
Okay, that's great. Thank you very much, Kate, and also thanks to the Q&I for inviting us, myself and colleagues here today. And I was very keen to come because of the agenda, which is very, very topical, as you're going to hear. I started life, actually, as you heard, as a junior doc in paediatrics, actually. And after 5 years, I then changed and went to the dark side of health policy analysis and policy. And so what I'm going to say today really draws on the more abstracted health policy side of my life, not the earlier paediatric side, although hopefully there'll be some points of contact. I've just come from a meeting last week, an international meeting, where I have to say some of the themes we've already pointed out were absolutely central. And this was a meeting where there weren't just people from Britain. There were people from Belgium, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Korea, China, Brazil, India. And everybody was talking about the need to have more integrated and more home-based care, no matter what the state of development of the health system. So what I would say is this isn't a flash in the pan, actually. This is, I think, as Kate said, a kind of tipping point where we're all at the moment. And this is driven in part by economics. You don't need me to tell you about the state of the economy. But more importantly than that, it's also driven by the information systems that we've now developed. We can now communicate to each other far more. And also what people now expect and are beginning to expect more of, that actually the health system should be a guest in our lives. We should not be the pawn to be directed by the health system. We invite the health system into our lives to help care for us when we choose or when we want. And this kind of flipping on its head our approach to care really, I think, is now becoming much more viral around the world. And coupled with that, the limits to medicine, not just the limits to science that we all know about, but also the limits to care that medicine can produce. I mean, I remember as a junior how little we actually cared for the children that we were dealing with. I mean, you just sort of swept in, did a test or two, did the diagnosis, but actually the caring was left to a wider group of carers, so that there are distinct limits to medicine. And the patients will be the centre of the care network in future. Okay, so this is all sort of warm and fuzzy words. So what does this mean in practice? Well, as we've heard, there will be more movements to support people at home and the community and away from institutions, not just for economics reasons, but also for health reasons. There will be more intense support for people at home, which means a complete change in our skill set of people who formerly were working with individuals at home, the skill set of nursing staff, the skill set of hitherto unheard of carers, but also social care support as well. There'll be far more communications technology of the types you will be using at the moment, both for patients and carers, and particularly if patients really do hold their electronic record or their carers hold that record. There's a lot of talk at the moment about telehealth and telecare, and you can't move for a kind of looking at supplements of healthcare journals without a telehealth supplement falling out of it. I think a lot of this is actually really overhyped, but nevertheless, it is a kind of dawning of a new way of interaction that we will see, even if the early results of telehealth and telecare aren't as promising in terms of reducing the flow of patients to hospital and helping in health as we would have hoped. I think it's just still in the early stages. There'll be a lot more care coordination, and particularly a focus on, of course, people who are frail, older people, and particularly people at the end of their lives. I think you know all of this, but actually it's a worldwide trend. There'll be smaller hospitals, there'll be faster access to specialists, from the home possibly, and the GP's role will change also, possibly becoming more specialised, and so on, and therefore the nurse role will change too. I've only got 5 minutes, so I'll just sort of have my third chunk of what I was going to say is, well, what do we see? Do we see signs of this happening now? There's tons of words, aren't there? But what's actually happening? Well, integration is all the rage. I mean, as you go around the health service, as you will hear people wanting to coordinate and integrate care and do the kinds of things that we've described, whether it's integration between primary care and hospital care, you know, to remove the walls, start thinking about physiology across those systems, not anatomy, not the buildings, not about professional tribes, but about the care process across NHS and social care. I have to say the evaluations of emerging interventions to try to integrate care are still pretty iffy. You know, the results, we've done a lot of these evaluations. At the moment, they're not really helping to avert the need for costly hospital care, and they're not necessarily improving quality in the way we hope. But again, I think this is because it's in the early stage. I've talked about telehealth. Again, the evaluations are still a bit iffy. And there are tons of policies to try to encourage integration, whether it's from the economic side of things, financial incentives, or regulation through the CQC. Okay, so that's all coming. It's all part of the language. I don't think there'll be a reversal. And given our economic situation in health over the next 20 years, there isn't going to be that much funds, and I think the economic stimulus will still be there. Somebody at the back absolutely mentioned the money, the SIPs, the cost improvement programs, the reconfigurations that are slashing nurse numbers. I think this is clearly an issue. It's lack of social care funding is clearly an issue. But we absolutely have not and do not demonstrate at the moment enough the impact of cuts on actually causing more problems, which is more avoidable hospitalizations. And I think this is our problem. We have tons of information around, but we don't use it enough to see what the impact of service changes are, whether they're about cuts or whether they're about integration. So finally, I suppose my main message is that, as I said earlier, this is a wide world trend. Ministers come and go. They have their own pet ideas. But this sort of development is actually going to be here for the next 20 years. I think you'll see an enormous upheaval in your lives as your skill set and your expectations of you will grow, and as hospitals depend more on you than they ever have before. So what I would probably try and encourage you is just to think carefully about it. This is not going to go away. This is something that you can really respond to. And quite frankly, you are now in the prime position more than ever before to affect this and become much more centre stage in the health system than you ever were, and as you should be. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Jennifer. Mike.
thanks. And thank you very much for inviting me in those very kind words of introduction. I'd like to build on what Jennifer was talking about and sort of think about, when we talk about a tipping point for care around home-based care, what are we actually talking about? Because it seems to me that the vast majority of people in this audience can defend and already understand as part of their day-to-day experience that the focal point for care is in people's homes. The vast majority of episodes of care occur while someone is living at home. So when we're talking about a tipping point, what are we really getting at? And it seems to me what we're getting at is, despite the fact that the vast majority is delivered whilst people live at home, even when they're ill, the fact is that the focal point for the power in the service and the focal point for debate amongst the public is around hospital-based care or indeed residential-based care, which seems to be completely odd given that our experience is that people do get care at home. So I just want to sort of touch on, in my 5 minutes, thinking about why that happens and what do we need to do if we're going to change that. I mean, it seems to me that further moves towards being able to look after people at home is inexorable. So, all of the things that Jennifer pointed to by way of the opportunities for diagnosis earlier, access to specialist care outside of hospitals, all of that points to saying the focal point will increasingly be at home. We're not going to see a shift in a different direction. The public debate, it seems to me, we've allowed to be sort of taken away from us in terms of thinking about what the public lose by way of changing hospital-based provision rather than what they gain by way of investing in community provision. And, if you want some analogies, where were the front lines to save the isolation hospitals when we realised that we could care for people with communicable disease whilst in situ in their own homes? That didn't happen because we changed the model of care. People accepted it was the right thing to do. I talk a little bit about this because it's so recent in my experience. It's a personal experience of my mum's care. We lost my mum just before Easter. She had vascular dementia. But she went into a care home just before Christmas. Now, my dad, who was caring for her, my mum and dad had spent 60 years together. They'd only had one night apart in 60 years. So that day that we had to say to my dad, look, my mum's going to have to go into a care home, is probably the worst day of my dad's life. And even now when I talk to him, the remorse he has about the fact that he couldn't look after my mum at home. So in terms of our emotions about losing people to be cared for outside of our homes, the public sympathy, the public mood has got to be around how can we help ourselves stay at home for longer? How can we make sure that the care is available to us at home? And yet we have allowed the debate to be about what people are losing by way of transferring resources from hospitals to communities. We have failed to connect with the public. So the first thing that we need to do around a tipping point of getting the focal point of care and the way the systems operate to think about community is to change the nature of the public debate and try and help people, not by talking about reconfiguration or more integration, but by telling stories about what it means to have care based on someone's life at home, or indeed their having a good death at home, because I believe that's where the public sympathy really is, if we could manage to change the nature of the debate. The second point, and why this is so important, is because if we do want the focal point for the way the service works to be around care, then we've got to have mechanics in the system that actually support it rather than work against it. It's too hard for managers and staff on the ground still to do the right thing by getting more resources into community services. We have to do it despite the system. So the tariffs reward hospital-based care. The incentive system for training and development rewards spending more time in hospital than community. If you look at my colleagues at the top of the leadership of the general management ladder, almost all of them come out of hospital careers. They don't come out of having worked in community. And yet, ironically, the complexity, the leadership skills that it needs to work in community, because you're working across boundaries, you're working in partnerships with local authority, you're having to recognise and value people's own experience when you work in people's homes, all of those things are actually more complex leadership challenges than working in institutionalised care, whether it's the old mental hospitals that we used to have, and then we trained and supported people to deploy their skills in communities, or indeed currently the acute environment that we train people in. It is more complex. We should value and create systems that support community-based services. I don't believe, for example, that it's possible to facilitate the journey that we will see around creating more community-based resources without tackling some of the boundaries with the general medical services contract. And I was one who negotiated it back in 2002. You know, we can't talk about community services somehow splendidly isolated from the incentives and the resources that go in for general practice. That has to be made more available holistically to support people's care at home, irrespective of what the sort of balance of care is. And I think therein lies one of our great challenges, which is that when we talk about models of community-based services, we're largely talking about care-based services with a medical adjunct rather than medical-based services with a care adjunct. And, of course, one of the things that starts to challenge is it threatens the way in which our power is distributed across the NHS, where largely, as I say, hospitals have held sway over community and largely medicine has held sway over nursing and other care professions. So one of the kind of key things that we've got to do is we've got to unpack this, and we've got to challenge it, and we've got to say, for the future, this is not the right thing to do. The last thing I wanted to make is the other bit that we've got to knock over is that all of this is happening because we've got to save money. Jennifer's already pointed to the fact that, you know, a lot of the cuts that are being made in community, and therefore we're actually moving the opposite direction in terms of the incentives in the system. This is the right thing to do. I come back to my dad. It was the worst day of my dad's life to lose the ability to care for my mum at home. He's not unique. He's not any different to the vast majority of us. We would want that. We've got to find ways of engineering our system so that it's fit for purpose to support you. And the last thing that I would say is about our own mindsets in this room. I've worked around hospitals, I've worked in community, I've worked in all kinds of places. There's a great phrase that comes out of politics which I always hold on to, which was James Connolly talking about bosses and workers, and he said the reason that workers look up to bosses is because workers are on the knees. There is something about our attitude around working community and standing up for this. This is where the forefront of science will be. This is where the forefront of care will be. And this is where, to be frank, the sustainable future of the NHS will be. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mike. Jeremy.
Thank you very much. Can you hear me? Thank you also for the invitation to be here. Thank you, everybody in this room, for all the fantastic work you do to support and look after patients. It is really important. And as has been said, there's a sense in which it's a little bit too below the radar. We're all focused on doctors in white coats and what goes on in A&E and not enough on what happens in the day-to-day work that you do. National Voices, you can be almost forgiven for having heard of us if you haven't. We've been going for about 4 years, but our aim is very much to become more and more well known. We're the national, in England, the National Coalition for Health and Social Care Charities and the voluntary sector in health and social care. And our aim is to make the views and voices and insights and perspectives of patients and carers and families just better embedded in all parts of our health and social care system. Many of the points that I want to make have been stolen by the other speakers, but that just so shows how influential we're becoming. So I would start by saying we kind of know a lot about what patients want already. They want good quality, compassionate care, which is joined up, not fragmented, which is as close to home as possible, which gives them a voice and a say and the ability to be involved and for their families to be involved. They want to be looked after when they need to be looked after, but they want to be in control as much as they want to be as well. And a lot of the healthcare debate is really about how you get the right balance for each individual between being looked after and being supported to look after yourself. All of that means, and I absolutely echo everything that's been said about quality. Quality should be the organising principle of the NHS. That's what Darcy said. It isn't quite like that at the moment, and it should be. Quality being the organising principle would mean that we did far more in the community, far more in primary care, far more in people's homes. Tipping point, I mean, I always like to argue with the question that's been set, so I'm not sure tipping point is quite right, because we will still need hospitals. We will still need the care that cannot be provided at home. We need to do that better, which is why we need to use the jargon, reconfigure it. And Mike is absolutely right to say that we need to have a different kind of conversation with the public and with everybody about what a future hospital service would look like, so that we can also have a future community service which is much better developed and much more joined up. And I think that is probably partly about stopping using awful jargon like reconfiguration. Another jargon word that somebody used today, cost improvement program. I hate that because that's a slippery euphemism for cutting. And it would be much more honest to say we have to make some cuts. We don't want to, but we have to. Than talk about cost improvement. I just don't like that. I think it's a dishonest term. So I don't think we're talking about tipping point. We're maybe talking about a series of milestones on the journey towards a better pattern of care. And I just wanted to say a few things about what I thought those milestones would be. How would we know we were moving in the right direction? Well, number one would be that it would start to feel genuine when we talked about quality being the organising principle, because at the moment it's not, and too many decisions are being made, frankly, on the basis of cost. And I think there is something about everybody, particularly this profession, people in this room, having the confidence to be able to speak out if they think that their ability to deliver their job well is being compromised. And I'll say a bit more about that in a tick. I think one of the, so quality genuinely being the organising principle. Second one, for me, is something about a system which is no longer in a kind of collective denial about who we're looking after these days. And this has been said particularly in the hospital context, so the Royal College of Physicians in their recent report on hospitals at the edge, ? There's a quote in there which says, it's at best, it sometimes feels as though we meet the needs of very elderly people with surprise every time they come in, and at worst, with a sense of unwelcome and hostility. I think it's much better in the community, but I think the whole system needs to start to work as though we recognise that the vast majority of the need now comes from the oldest people in our society, often with dementia, often with very complex needs. That might not be what people signed up to do when they joined the profession. So we need to think about aligning the recruitment and the training and the values with a sense of what is the need these days, because it's not the same as it was 20 or 30 years ago. So another milestone for me will be something about the reality of this document, which I like, the NHS Constitution. I declare an interest. I'm on a working party that's looking at how it can be strengthened. The work that we do will culminate in a public consultation on strengthening the NHS Constitution a bit later on this autumn. I'd really encourage everybody to kind of have their voice heard on what would it mean to strengthen the NHS Constitution. Because to me, it's clear that it isn't just about having fine words in a document that many people have not heard of, but actually how you use that document to make a difference to the way care is delivered and how you use it to be able to challenge the system if it's not working for you as a patient or indeed as a nurse. Another milestone for me would be something that looked as though we really were transforming primary care, building it up, making it joined up with community services and social care services, There's been a lot of talk about that, as Jennifer was saying, for quite a long time. Actually, the talk about integration has been going on probably for 20 or 30 years, but there's no sign of it really happening yet. So one of the things that we are agitating for is let's get on with this and start to do it. Part of it is about how we can get resources out of the acute sector in a way that doesn't make everybody feel hostile, but it's also about having the will to develop the service that we know we need so we can give a joined-up set of care services to patients. We've also agitated, and we'll have to continue to do so, for, as has been referred to already, a resolution of the problem of social care funding. So we need to do DILNOT. The DILNOT Commission came up with some fantastic recommendations to build on. They may not be the final say, they may not be perfect, but they're the first port of call. But what we see from actually all the political parties is what seems to be a sophisticated game of kicking it into the long grass again. And actually we can't afford to wait to get social care funding sorted out, because the inability to do that means we compromise the quality of care and make it really difficult to reform NHS care. So I would invite you to add your voices to the clamour for getting on and sorting out the funding of social care. Finally, I think there needs to be something. A milestone for me would be that we start to make a reality of the notion of an NHS that really listens to patients and listens to staff. So Sally's referred to the friends and families test. I think that's fine. It's good. It will take us a bit further, but it's quite a high-level, superficial measure. And I think what we really need is for all care organisations, actually all individual care professionals, to be really listening to what their patients are saying, what the carers are saying, and to be responding to that. It was very interesting as part of my research for this. I read the survey that Q and I did this time last year on people's experience and attitudes to care in the home from nurses. It's a fantastic story. Most people think it's really, really good. A smaller minority have problems with it. Some people talk about nurses being too rushed, talking over them, not listening. And where people are really satisfied with their care, one of the key components of that is nurses who really listen, who really respond. It's so important, and we need to do a lot more to make a reality of listening, not just by having complicated high-level measures that politicians can quote back, but actually what happens in the interaction between individual nurses and their patients and with their families. Finally, it is really important that the system listens to staff. So everything around being able to speak out with confidence, knowing that you won't be pilloried, knowing that you won't be sacked, knowing that your career won't be compromised is really, really important. And I think today a number of organisations have published a speaking out charter, which is really about trying to get the whole system to commit to really making it possible for ordinary staff to speak out without fear of the consequences in the interests of patients. I think in a world where money is really tight, it's going to be more and more important that all of you have the confidence to be able to speak out. That's all for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Last but not least, Wendy.
I'm not sure there's very much left for me to say, really, is there? I've been in a really privileged position over the last 6 months that I've been working with QNI as our strategic partners and many other district nurses, community nursing services, to look at how we develop a new vision and a new model for how we move forward with the profession and how we actually really capture that uniqueness of what the profession can actually provide and what it does actually provide. And you'll be hearing a little bit more about that this afternoon. But just listening to the other panel members, I think before we can actually start thinking about integration and moving forward, I think part of the process has to be about almost unpicking some of that. Looking at the interconnectivity of all the community nursing services and the key partners such as social care, and then actually start thinking, how do we articulate how we actually explore with the public what it is that we're actually trying to deliver and actually tell that story? And clearly the work that we've done over the last 6 months has given us quite an insight in terms of, do our partners really understand the complexity, the diverse range of skills that community nursing services have? Do they understand how dynamic you actually are and what the complex care that you actually provide in the home setting is? Do hospital staff really understand that dynamic care? And I would say they probably don't. I think it's only when you actually start trying to put it down on paper that you begin to understand the uniqueness. And we started off in a room at Q&I's headquarters
with flip charts, actually being able to think about what makes you unique, what makes you special, and what contributions you actually make. And it was quite alarming, really, that district nurses found it difficult, and I think that's because they hadn't been given the space previously to be able to do that. It wasn't that they didn't know how to say what they did, but it was actually almost about being given permission to say, we are different, we are unique, and we can actually provide very complex care in the community. We're very well respected by our patients, but we just need to actually be able to articulate it very simply. So we've been on a journey over the last 6 months to actually be able to do that, and it's been incredible. And I think certainly the passion for quality is overwhelming within the profession. We've heard about some really good examples about integration. We've heard about some examples where maybe integration with social care isn't actually working. And that's probably because we haven't got those tools that the other panel members have talked about. And we need to think, what tools do we need to develop to actually help you to deliver the quality that you want to deliver? Because there is this desire to actually improve and aim higher continually. And we can keep reaching higher and higher, but we're not actually going to achieve that if we haven't got those tools to actually help us. I think for me, one of the key things that's actually been transferred from you is that ability to be able to act as the patient's advocate, to be able to actually hold and to be that glue for that patient. And when we've been talking to some small patient groups, they've told us that quite often community nursing services is that navigator, that compass that takes you through that huge maze of health services. They actually take you by the hand and lead you through a journey so that you can get some of that care that you need. And without that, they can't actually achieve it quite often because they do feel quite vulnerable, particularly the elderly. So I think we need to reflect on the patient experience and the experience of carers, and we haven't really talked or touched very much on carers very much. And through some of the work that we're doing in the department, we're thinking about how do we actually improve the health and wellbeing of carers so that they can actually support and provide some of that essential care within the community, because they are quite often who patients want to provide that care. It isn't a huge tirade of people coming into somebody's home. It's about their carers that they actually want, the people who know them, the people they trust, but with some support from the professional groups. So we need to actually start thinking about some of those tools about gaining the patient experience and actually listening to those patient stories. The patient stories for me really bring things alive, and listening to the range of issues that patients have in the community is quite remarkable. It actually brings alive a lot of the policy that we develop, and we can start then thinking about what would be the fundamentals of a new nursing vision, what would be the new fundamentals of a new community vision for community district nurses. And I think that's where we are at the moment with the new national nursing strategy. If we look at the six C's, which I'm sure you've all had ingrained upon you, they are really, really important for community nursing services. They are the bedrock, really, of what we actually deliver and of what you deliver and what you stand for. And they provide us a platform to actually develop that vision even further and to be able to demonstrate to others about the diverse range of skills and expertise that you actually bring and that complexity. So we need to embrace that as a profession. We need now to start thinking about those priority actions, and we need to start thinking about how can we use those priority actions to really help us to get into that position now where we can improve quality and we can deliver at that tipping point. We know we need to have that shift of care. We know that we need to actually shift that care to home, but we need to actually make sure that people understand what it is that you can actually provide in the community. That brings us to the workforce. And clearly, our student nurses are the future, aren't they? They will be providing care in the future. The care that they provide will be based very much on the experience they have as students when they're on placement with you, and how you actually prepare them, and how we actually change their mindset. And I was recently with a group of students and asking them what their career options were and what they were thinking about. And very few wanted to actually think about the community and about community nursing. And when we delved a little bit deeper, we found that they were still under the impression that you needed to have 2 years post-grad experience in the hospital before you could actually think about being in the community. So clearly we need to actually think about how do we change their mindset? How do we actually inspire them, give them more food for thought? perhaps think about placements more innovatively and actually capture their mind when they are very captive as student nurses, because I think for us that is really important. And probably the final thing I want to say, because you've all been listening very patiently, is I think we do need to think about that evidence. We do need to think about that impact. Quite often, community nurses are very busy actually doing rather than thinking about evidence and impact. But that evidence and impact is really crucially important. That's actually going to influence future commissioning decisions. It's actually going to look at how we allocate resources. So it is equally as important as delivering that care. And we need to think about how do we equip you with the tools to be able to use that evidence much more effectively and to actually build on that in terms of the JSNA. I think I'll stop.
Great. Thank you very much, Wendy. Okay. Questions. Over to you. You've heard a lot of thinking going on. Give us your responses, your feelings, your comments, your questions. We'll take three questions first, okay? There's three all on that side. The lady, one, two, three.
Hello, I'm Debbie Quinn. I'm an MS specialist nurse based in the community, one of the first in the country, in Northamptonshire. One of my biggest issues now, listening to all of what you're saying, is the fact that the acute services are really adamant that they need to move specialist services back into the hospital. I'm in the middle of an argument at the moment saying I don't want to go there. I want to stay where I am in the community. It is where it should be based. I've got admission avoidance data. I've got loads of data to save it. But what you've got to remember is the acute services are really precious now about maintaining their services and keeping themselves alive. And I think we've got a real battle going on about how we can move forward on that.
Great. Thanks, Debbie. What, behind you?
Hello, I'm Sue Harness. I speak as a very proud Queen's nurse. I speak as a senior lecturer at the University of Cumbria on the district nursing pathway, and I speak as an active member of the ADNE, Association of District Nurse Educators, which is a national forum. And I'm sure everyone who's a Queen's nurse and a district nurse here feels like doing cartwheels at the moment around the studio. Listening to all that enthusiasm about community nursing and district nursing. Yes, we recognise that we're a very dynamic workforce. We're the only workforce who works 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. The rising complexity of our patients in the home necessitates qualified district nurses. And I think the bottom line is we're not training enough district nurses. Speaking from personal experience at the University of Cumbria, based at Lancaster, we've had numbers ranging from 17 in the last few years, 2 and 4, of the whole of Cumbria and North Lancashire. We're not training enough district nurses to deliver the care that you have got envisaged. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. Okay.
Hi, Gail Adams, Head of Nursing for Unison. And I think to build on the previous colleague's comments, it's not just about the numbers of district nurses which are dropping, it's also about the age profile of the profession overall and the challenges that that places. And I'm speaking not as a district nurse, and I hasten to add. But I think one of the benefits of the health visiting programme is that there were figures that were attached to it, there was a national strategy that was attached to it, and there isn't a comparable one for the community at this moment in time. So I think that healthcare at home is an absolutely fundamental part of it. But for me, home is where the patient is telling us it is. So whether that's a homeless person or somebody who prefers to choose residential care as opposed to home care, I think it's really important that we take that into account. And also the landscape of community nursing is changing. It's not just district nurses and community nurses. It's also support workers who are working with them who are being expected to undertake a broadening role. So for me, the tipping point is in order to get healthcare at home, we need to get the workforce in the community to facilitate the care at home. And that needs to be before the transition of that ethos, because without it, we will be raising expectations of patients and then not able to deliver the service that they've been advised that they can receive, which leads to frustration on their point and their families and their carers, because their perception is they're not getting the care that they need. And I think the comment about district nursing being a 24/7 service is very real. And I'm concerned at the reducing numbers of staff who are on weekends and on nights. That means that we have got unnecessary admissions into the acute sector because there aren't people there to be able to manage the conditions at home. So I think there's a whole workforce agenda that if we can get that right, if we can train more staff, if we can support them, if we can continue to offer them professional development amongst that whole multidisciplinary team, we will achieve healthcare at home, whether that's end of life or managing a long-term condition or simply managing an older person's care needs at home, whether they be simple or complex. And I think there are some fantastic lessons that we can learn from the devolved countries. In Northern Ireland, for example, Kells Surprise, they have health and social care services commissioned in an integrated way. So whether you're a district nurse or a GP, you go back into the office. If there's an issue with a patient, you can physically speak to your colleague. And there is still quite a protracted paperwork trail about how we liaise with other members of the multidisciplinary team. So I would like district nurses to have much more power and control about the people that they are caring for, because they're the ones who have the relationship with them. GPs have a very important role to play, but it doesn't all begin and end with them. It's about who is the most appropriate person to have that conversation and making sure that they're trained and that they are there to work when patients need. And there is genuinely a major problem about the numbers of staff who are on out of hours and at weekends that correlates more money being spent on unnecessary acute admission referrals.
Thank you, Gail. OK, some great questions, points there that I'd like our panel to respond to. One is about services being pulled back into hospitals, and the other one, in a way, is what do we do now to build the workforce in order to be prepared for this new future, and what comes first? Who'd like to take? Jennifer?
Yep. Thanks. I think there's a link between all these questions. Mm-hmm. And looking at, in putting my analyst hat on now, if you look at the information that we've got across the health service available for commissioners now in their investment decisions, we've got a lot of information on hospital cost and quality. We've got some information on general practice cost and quality, but we have far less information about what goes on in the community in terms of activity, cost, quality, and so on. I don't know why that's happened, but it's a fact. And until there can be better demonstration that there is cost and that there is effective and efficient care, which you all know you can deliver, until there is factual evidence of that on a wider scale, I think there will be not the investment that is needed that we're talking about. And so I know there's a trade-off here. You want everybody who's a clinician wants to see patients. They don't want to fill in paperwork. They don't want to sit at a terminal. But there is an issue here. Until we can demonstrate, particularly to commissioners now, not necessarily to acute hospitals who may never, turkeys never vote for Christmas, until we can demonstrate to the commissioners far more clearly in cold, factual, quantitative way that actually investment in community services really does improve quality for patients and is efficient, until we can do that, I think we're going to see this kind of short-term blind cutting. And so the question is, how do we then use the data? And then people like us at the Nuffield would use it in order to demonstrate we'd love to.
Is this something you'd be prepared to perhaps help with?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. Thanks, Jennifer.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I want to pick on the workforce issues and the numbers. In the last 2 or 3 weeks, because it's been party conference, we all go around the country following the politicians to their party conferences and end up talking to all the people who are lobby groups like ourselves. So it's kind of a bit. But I've been talking to a number of Royal Colleges, all who believe that the answer to the NHS's problems is more of their groups. So the GPs want more GPs. The physicians believe there should be more physicians. And so with the financial position that we're in, the key question is, where would you make a strategic investment? Where could you and should you prioritise investment? I actually believe that we should be spending more money in community services, and I personally would support more investments in district nurses. However, this is where I start becoming unpopular. I also think that there's a good deal that could be done to help improve the number of people that district nurses are able to see and help by giving them the support and structure. And this comes back to things I was saying before about we had big investments around IT over the last 6 years, but not in community services, where had we put more investment into IT and community services, I think we would have been in a better position to support, using the awful word, more productivity, but actually seeing more people in community nurses. So I actually believe that it would be a strategic investment, and certainly with Health Education England now taking responsibility, I'm hopeful that the new leadership there will take a very positive view about investing in the areas that you're talking about. But I also think, like all of us in the health service, we've got to demonstrate that we are using the resources we do have as efficiently as possible. And, you know, community is not immune from having to look at itself and say, could we do better? Even if it means then making a case to say we could do better if we were given better resources around things like IT support. Mm.
Thank you, Mike. And would you be prepared to help us with some of that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah? Yeah, great, thank you. Jeremy, do you want to?
Just a couple of quick things to add to that. I mean, the story about specialist services going back into hospital seems to be a classic one of where's the commissioner? You know, where are they in all this? They should be somewhere. They're probably too busy setting themselves up and getting authorisation. So we've got a bit of a problem right now of a kind of planning blight, as it were, as the whole system in England gets re-engineered. And I think, meanwhile, organisations are pursuing their organisational interests, which may not coincide with the patient interest. My second point is really about, I mean, I think evidence is really important, and Jennifer's absolutely right just to point out the gaps. But it's also the case that the development of an integrated community-based primary care service of one kind or another has been the direction of policy for, you know, a couple of decades at least. So I think there's also a sense of following through on what we know is the right thing, gathering evidence as we go along, maybe doing some kind of meta-study of what we already know just to see how strong it is. But I think here there's a real case for getting on with it rather than stopping and waiting to amass more evidence before we can make the case for making the changes that we all agree with.
Just to follow on from that, I mean, there is a lot of evidence, and I think certainly we heard from Sally about the collection of good practice, and we've been investigating various models with the Community Nurse Advisory Group we've been working with. So there is the information out there, and we do need to use it. We need to learn, and we need to build on it. It's not like starting with a blank piece of paper. It's actually using that as the platform to start. So it's not going backwards. It's actually moving forward.
Okay, thank you. And I've got time for some very quick questions. So if anybody's got a quick question to put to the panel. Yep, one here. Two on the left, all on the same side of the room. None from this side.
Hi, I'm Fiona Ross. I'm a district nurse. I'm Wade Back, and currently day job, I'm Dean of a faculty at Kingston University in St George's. I hope it's going to be quick, but I actually have three points I wanted to make. One is that I qualified as a district nurse a long time ago in the last century, and I feel that lots have changed, but nothing's changed. When I listen to the debates that are going on now, actually, the policy around community care has been going on for about 40 years. We still have this tug of war between the acute organisational interests and primary care, community care concerns. And so we need to address that. I went into district nursing having had a degree, and went straight from being a student into district nursing. Can't do that now. It's difficult to do that now. There is a mindset of a resistance to it. But even then, the nursing officers, and this tells you how old I am, thought I was making a very bad decision for my career. They thought it was a death knell. Why on earth would a graduate want to do district nursing? It was going nowhere. But it was absolutely the best thing that I did, because it was the only way in which I felt I could really deliver the care that I wanted to do, had been trained to do, to give personal care to people in their homes where
Sorry,
they wanted
Fiona,
to be.
Sorry, Fiona, can you just because I
so
know
that's my.
Writing.
Can you hear me? So that's
yes,
the first
I just
point.
Want you to speed up to yeah. finish off if you could.
The second point is about the non-replacement strategy for district nurses, and I think we need to look at that in terms of workforce commissioning, and if the ageing of the workforce tells a story there. The third issue really is based on evidence, the research that. I've been doing actually with Sally around the professional experience of looking after people in the community. What came out of that work was that district nurses felt they were not being valued because of their generic role, while the specialist roles that have arisen in the last 5-10 years are more valued. So my question to the panel is, does the system value generic roles, generalist roles, and what's the sorts of skill mix should we have in the future going forward if we are to deliver integrated care?
Okay, and there was one last. Okay, the very last question, very quickly, if you could please.
I'll be brief. Rosalind Godson from Unite the Union. Just 2 points. Jeremy Taylor rightly mentioned whistleblowing. I have to tell you from a union point of view that whistleblowers are not well regarded out in the community or anywhere else. And Sally mentioned the culture and values of the organisation. And I think a lot more work needs to be put onto the culture and values of the organisations that nurses work within. Because we have lots of wonderful leadership going on by nurses, but some very poor management going on out there.
Okay, thank you, Ros. Okay, very quick response before we break for coffee. Starting with you, Wendy.
Okay. I mean, in terms of the culture and values, I think the National Nursing Strategy provides us with something to actually hang off of our values for community nursing. So I think that's a huge step forward. And one of those core values is about courage. And obviously that actually encompasses some of the issues about when things are not going right, having the courage to be able to say so. So I think we need to actually hold on to those values and use them in the most appropriate way.
Thank you, Wendy. Jennifer, anything?
I'm not sure. On the specialisation and generic issue, I just notice in medicine, and that this is the issue with the Royal College of Physicians Future Hospital Commission, on which I sit, that there's been almost unchecked subspecialisation. And, it's easy for people to just want to do that. But that can lead to fragmentation and, of course, de-skilling of, more of a holistic, more generic view. So I think the RCP, certainly, as far as the medicine is concerned, is seriously looking at this again and thinking that the balance is not right. And I don't know whether there's the equivalent in nursing that is going on, but it might be quite useful to dock that with the physician's efforts.
That would be... Thank you very much. That's a very good idea. Thank you. Jeremy, anything else?
Just a quick one on whistleblowing. Because it's so hard to whistleblow in practice, even though there are legal protections, and because there's still a culture of not being open about things going wrong, we're one of the organisations that supports a statutory duty of candour so that where there are failings, they have to be shared with patients and families. I think that would be a potential game changer in terms of transparency and openness.
Thank you. Mike, last word to you.
Well, just to reflect on the issue about poor management and good quality nursing, it seems to me that all systems need that balance of good quality management and organisation and the professional conduct and good quality care that individuals bring, and it's a balance of the two. You do get organisations where their community shifts, for example, where shift A is wonderful, shift B is terrible, same organisation, what makes the difference? I don't think external regulation, I'm worried about Francis externalising and saying more inspection, more registration. I think staff give great care when they feel really, really valued, not really, really inspected. So I think getting the balance right is a very important thing for us to find.
Great. An excellent way to finish this session. Thank you very much to all our speakers. Lots of thoughts there. I think lots of work for the Q&I to think about what we can take forward with our colleagues from the panel today. So can you just join me in thanking them very much for coming today?
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.